Hi, from New York City. Sunday night, and this is the technician. Stand by while I check something here. Okay, I'm hooked up to the right antenna. That's good. For those who are interested in ham radio, you're in the right place. The curious gather on Sunday night, and they teach each other how all this electronics works. This is TechNet number 1489 of the series of TechNets that began approximately September of 1982. KD2BD has brought to my attention that maybe I'm wrong by a couple of months, but it's in that vicinity. So it's not 31 years, it's 30 and a half years. Close enough. In the right ballpark, if you know what I mean. Person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or a comment. Let me drop. He does have a question or a comment by giving us your call letters, your name, and the word yes. You need not sign in because you're listening. After 30 and a half or 31 years, we believe somebody is listening. That's sort of been proven to us a long time ago. A typical sign-in would sound something like this. K1MJM, Mike, and yes. So give me your call letters right now if you've got a question or a comment. K2LIW.
NPO, Dick, with a comment to you.
Rich recognized. Anyone else?
You. Name is Joe, and yes.
Joe, give me your call letters. You got covered by somebody else. Go ahead, Joe.
This is KC2QYW.
We got you, QYW. Okay. We got Rich and Joe. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2FIZ.
Okay, it sounds like KD2 Foxtrot India Zulu is what it sounded like. You didn't give it to me phonetically, and you didn't give me your name. FIZ question mark, K2LIW, go ahead.
KD2FIZ, John.
Okay, John, we got you. Anyone else assigned to the segment? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD4UJH, George, no.
Okay, George with a no. Anyone else with a yes to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
S2N, Paul, with the space report. Good evening to everybody on the net.
This is DPZ with the quickie answers.
Yeah, each person, as you give me your question, either proceed or succeed, whichever you like. Tell us whether or not you want Hal's quick question, quick answer, K60PZ, or for his quick answers, or do you want the more full answer, the more verbose answer that K2LAW normally gives. So indicate that when we come around to you as to which kind of answer you want. All right, one last call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet because they do have a question or a comment? Give me a call letters and name right now. Okay, there being none, we got more than enough to get started. Rich, N2EO, when you give your comment, tell us if you want to give a brief comment or a longer comment. Do you want Hal to help you with the comment, or do you want Rich to help you with the comment? Case, I'm having some fun with you. N2EO, K2IW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, this is Dick, N2EO, and not a very long comment. You said this net started in the early 80s. But let me remind you, I believe it went back to 1976, when it was on the 400 repeater. It was at that point WR2HCD. The repeating owner was Dave Minot. And it was called the Amateur TV and Technical Net. You were picking up me and other people were running ATV. I believe that was the setup that was built by Ed Tiller. WTKPQ now deceased, and later on when we moved over here to Weimar, and it just evolved. So that's my comment. And Dick, I wanted to say also, I'm out of the hospitals now, And it's all three no more hospitalizations. I have a home health care aide here, and we're on the Tech at Limark, and to the
Yeah, Rich is giving us more of the history of the actual TechNet. The very first TechNet was called Amateur Television and Technical Net. It was hosted by Ed Ziller, W2KTQ, roughly 1975-1976, on Limark. Started off on Limark, 75-76. I think it was every Wednesday night. Ed had a one-hour production. He was setting up an amateur television repeater transmitter in Plainview, Long Island, on the four-sided tower that's in that location. It's on Northwoods Road, I think is the name of the place. And so for about 1 year, he was doing amateur television retransmissions, fast scan television, from around 1975 to 1976. That was the Amateur Television and Technical Net. Now you move up to 1982, and the 14600-146-40 input, that repeater in New York City, let me drop. Just figured out where the feedback is coming from. that repeater normally would rebroadcast astronaut audio during a space shuttle mission, and their particular connection one Sunday evening to the astronaut audio pickup failed. I have a television receive-only terminal in one of these 10-foot dishes that was receiving direct satellite reception from NASA Select, and I started pouring the audio directly through the input of the 14700 repeater, replacing the audio that had failed from their previous link. Various people said, where is that coming from? I then explained that I've got this dish at the 60-foot level of my tower in order to clear my 80-foot high trees so I can get satellite reception. And that started a whole series of questions. N2FDJ, HIP, among others, along with Dave Minot, asked details of what I was doing. And they asked me to come back the next Sunday to give more details. And then the next Sunday after that. That was the real beginning of the TechNet. For the next couple of years, let me drop. For the next couple of years, the TechNet was located on the 14700 machine. Then it moved, after a few years, then it moved over to Limark, where it has been ever since. I'm going to guess roughly 1984, 1985. From then on, it was on this particular frequency. So, interesting past history. Hip and I were running the TechNet way back in those days. We assumed that there was a thirst for knowledge. We assumed that we would answer people's questions, and pretty soon their questions would be answered. We'd dry up and go away. We thought that would take about a month. And here we are 30 years later, because there's always a brand new cast of characters. There's brand new thirst for knowledge. There's brand new techniques. There's 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio, more than they're being invented every day with digital techniques and so on. So there's a huge thirst of knowledge that we're slowly discovering. John and I, KC2WG, are discovering that that thirst for knowledge, we think, will never be thoroughly satisfied. There'll always be somebody with further questions. How does this all work? Wireless itself, let me drop. The way wireless engineering is taught in our schools needs a huge amount of improvement. We do not turn out wireless engineers, even though you go to a good school of higher learning in which you say, I want to learn communications technology with the transmitters, receivers, and antenna. I want to learn that. And you take the average student coming out of that school and you ask them what is an antenna. And you get a deer in the headlight experience, a deer in the headlight response. Antennas are just barely mentioned in those classes. And all of this great transmitting and receiving hardware would be absolutely useless if you didn't connect it to a good transmitting and receiving antenna. And for reasons that are mysterious to me, antennas are barely covered, and they're covered in a way that does not give useful engineering information. The method by which we teach what little bit of antenna technology we teach in our schools does not allow a person to whistle that tune, walk out of that class, and go out and earn a living designing antennas. The way you get an antenna engineer these days is you have to have at least a 10-year apprenticeship of that guy with sufficient interest working for a company is doing that work. Bunch of opinions on my part. Okay, we're going to go over to the next person who had a question. And that was Joe, KC2QYW. One of those curious guys who wants to know how antennas work. And you've come to the right place, Joe. KC2QYW, K2RYW. Go ahead with your question. And by the way, before you...
Is that possible concerning education?
So before you start with your question, Joe, tell us if you want the brief answer or do you want the more complicated answer. KC2QYW, K2RYW. You got it, Joe.
Yeah, roger that, roger that. Can you do 50-50, I guess? Okay, my question is, I noticed in the catalogs over here about different antennas, different companies. They all advertise no coils, no traps, no antenna tuner needed, and so forth. My question is... are these ads are like 100% 100% truth about these antennas that they're advertising, or they're just trying to make a trying to make a sale? That's my question. Back to the net.
Okay, we're gonna turn it over to Hal. Hal, give him the answer. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet. K6DPZ. Okay, Joe. From what you said, you know you're talking about a lot of different companies, a lot of different antennas. You have to be a little more specific. There are some companies that are pretty straightforward and say they're going to sell a half-wave antenna, MFED, multiband, or there are some companies that will say they'll just sell a vertical antenna that radials are needed because it's basically a quarter-wave antenna and it's loaded with traps for different frequencies. So you have to really do a little more research for the makes of the antenna, try and get documentation, and then from the documentation you can make a decision what should be best for the type of application you want. I personally suggest, you know, if you don't have a lot of space, go for an NFED half-wave antenna. Half-wave antenna does not require radials, but many times you have a limited space situation. It's very hard to put radials up. So that's the quickie. Now we're going to turn it over to Long John.
Wait to the beep, guys.
Go right ahead, Joe. You may have further information and or more questions on that. KC2QIW. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, let me be a little bit more specific. I could fit a dipole up and also a vertical up on my porch over here. So I guess I'll try to both out and do my research. I don't want to name any excuse me. I don't want to name any name brands over the radio here. Manufacturer name brands, because I don't think that would be fair, but I'm just talking about all the manufacturers out there. They all advertise that. Like this one here is a vertical, and it's saying no antenna tuner needed, and no radios, no traps, no coils. Personally, I still do use a antenna tuner, and I notice when I do use one, it works a lot better. So back to you guys, back to the net.
You want to take it or you want me to take it?
Joe, you've been overly restrictive. If you were in the business of selling ham radio equipment and you get on the air and you started mentioning brand names, then you would be advertising your business and you'd be violating some FCC rules. You're not an antenna seller. You're not a transmitter and receiver seller. We on the TechNet mention brand names. We talk about we like this Chris-Craft and we don't like that particular brand X antenna and so on. So you can mention brand names and now be specific about what you're really asking versus brand names. Go right ahead, Joe, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, sorry about that. I just don't feel comfortable mentioning brand names of, I'm looking into some verticals out there and a lot of the advertisements that they put them in the magazines, I'm scratching my head here. I'm thinking maybe they're just trying to trying to make a quick sale. I guess they're trying to persuade us the easier the better, but I'm not sure.
Can you give this with a fast answer to close it? Okay.
I was going to hand it to you, Hal.
I almost missed catching it. Okay, what I would suggest doing is going in on eCam and they have reviews on antennas and all sorts of stuff. Read the reviews about the different antennas, different other people's input about the different ones. Based on that, you should be able to make a judgment on what would be the best antenna for your application. How's that sound?
Okay, your signal was a little bit low when you said it. You said go in on ECAP. That's what it sounded like. Tell us the website you're recommending that Joe go to by which he could read reports on these antennas. Back to you, Hal.
Are those rumors true? Back to the net.
Tokyo High Power Belly, though. Yeah, that's too bad. When it comes to an antenna that works on multiple bands, Joe, one of the first things I would look at is a fan dipole. That's an extremely simple antenna, very high in performance, very low in cost if you build it yourself. And the fan dipole automatically switches as you go from 80 to 40 to 20 meters. The signal will flow down the right dipole automatically and doesn't flow down all the other complicated reasons as to why, but that's the way that works. And don't be afraid of later on if you've got the money and you want to buy an antenna tuner. And your particular antenna, your 80-meter antenna maybe gives you a pretty high standing wave ratio on the end of the band. And by way of the antenna tuner, you can thoroughly control that high standing wave ratio. A well-made antenna tuner is lossless. You can find almost everybody on 20 meters that will tell you that all the reflected power coming back to the antenna tuner, it just throws it away. Absolutely not true. It wastes no power. But don't be afraid of an antenna tuner if at some later time you want to use one. We've got a good set of questions here, Joe, and you're allowed to come back every week and ask those set of questions even more. Antennas are where we shine, and there's never enough antenna information, if you know what I mean, Joe. And come back and tell us what you discover as you do your further research in purchasing and building. John was the next person who asked us a question. Wait a minute now. John. John number two, I'm going to call. Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot India Zulu. You got it, John. And tell us if you want the brief answer or the complicated answer. KQRAWNTechNet. You got it, John.
Rich, I have comments on those antennas and the wheels.
Stand by, Rich. John, you're going to pick it up first, John, and wait for the beeps before you pick it up, John. Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot India Zulu. A man who signed in and said he's got a question. Go right ahead, John. We're waiting for you. KQRAW. Maybe John got called away, and we'll give him a little call later. You've got some further information on various antennas and the company that went out of business. Go right ahead, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay. N2EO. Yeah, you mentioned fan dipole. The only advantage you have is it's memorable resonance. You don't need a tuner. But I think you know what I'm going to say. I found what works best, you use a horizontal dipole. It's half range. It's the lowest frequency that you plan to use, or greater in length. Center, you feed it with open wire line, not coax. Open wire line to a tuner. It works fantastic on all bands. Fantastic.
Yeah, that was the solution that Rich chose, and he used it in Whitestone, and it worked like a charm for him. When he tried taking an 80-meter dipole and feeding it on multiple bands with coax, the extra loss of the coax, and you start getting into very high standing wave ratios. For instance, an 80-meter dipole on 40 meters will give you a standing wave ratio of probably 100 to 1, and your coax cable starts developing tremendous amounts of loss. When you're using properly installed open wire line, 100 to 1 standing wave ratio is no problem for the transmission line. And if you've got a broad enough range on your antenna tuner, you can now take a simple 80-meter dipole, and that's what Rich did, and by open wire line feeding it with a good broadband antenna tuner, he can make it work on every one of those bands. That's an approach that works very well for Rich. The fan dipole also works very well. By the way, the fan dipole, the good news, let me drop. The good news is that the fan dipole, if you build a fan for 80, 40, 15, and 10, for instance, 80, 40, 20, and 10, you might not have to build for 15 because it's very harmonic of a 40, but that fan dipole works very well on the center of each one of those bands. But if you really want to operate on the low end of 80 meters and the high end of 80 meters with your fan dipole, you might easily exceed a 1.5 standing wave ratio on the edges of the band. And depending on which no-tune transmitter you're using, it might start tripping out or going to lower power because of that standing wave ratio. So even with a fan dipole, if you're a serious operator across each one of those bands at the edges, you're probably going to want an antenna tuner. What's sad is that the rigs we used to buy, You take, for instance, your Collins rigs and your HW100 and your DX100, some of these Heath kits and other brands of rigs that were popular in the beginning. They were kind of large in size, but they had a real tuning and loading control. Let me drop. By way of that tuning and loading control, the antenna, the transmitter could easily match itself to reasonably high standing wave ratio. A 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. For most of those transmitters, no problem. Okay. Along comes a modern amateur who wants a compact, no-tune rig. On paper, it sounds good. It's smaller in size, and you don't have to do any tuning and loading controls. You don't realize what you gave up when you made that request. All of a sudden, now the rig has to have a 1.4-to-1 standing wave ratio, or better in some cases, in order to get full performance. So now, the wide tuning range you used to have, you don't have it anymore. You're now going to be very careful with the antenna. And if you didn't want to worry about the antenna, you're now buying back the antenna tuner you used to have. And now you'll make it as a separate box outside of the no-tune radio. Have we really come out ahead? I'm not so sure. It's a matter of who you talk to. It reminds me a little bit of the not-so-scrupulous contractor who you bought a piece of land. He scrapes away everything on the land, all the trees and topsoil and whatever, builds you a house, then he sells you back the topsoil that originally was there, if you know what I mean. So they've taken away the antenna tuner that used to be built into our rigs, and now they sell it to us as a separate box. And once you understand the theory of operation, you haven't lost anything, just that it's a different way of doing things. Any further comments or questions on what we've discussed so far, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very fast comment, K6DPZ on this.
Hal recognized, and is there anyone else? Okay, yeah. I'll wait for the beeps, and you got it, Hal.
Okay, SEP West antenna is 130 feet. Cut it in the center. Okay, there's 450 ohm ladder line, and it'll balance the antenna tuner. You got 80 through 10 meters. It works beautifully. It will tune up anywhere. That's my comment. It's better than a G5RV.
And now that's the second testimonial for that approach. Open wire, 80 meter, broadband antenna tune-up. That's what Rich used, and he's happy with it. That's what Hal used, and he's happy with it. I'm going to make an exception here, Hal. That is to say, when it comes to a broadband antenna tuner, that can tolerate those extremely high standing wave ratios you're going to get with an 80-meter dipole on, let's say, 40 meters, 20 meters, you're going to get an extremely high VISWR. So you want a balanced antenna tuner with wide tuning range. Please recommend for us a couple of brand names and model numbers of antenna tuners. I specifically requested that, not to worry about the legality. You've got it, Hal. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beeps.
Okay. Well, first of all, I don't use that configuration. My configuration is an NFED half-wave antenna, which we feed at the end, and it's like an inverted Z, but we feed it at the end, and it will work 160, 80, and 40, and use it on the 160 ground counterpoise. But the antenna tuners I'd recommend for your main applications of this type of antenna I mentioned would be either the old Johnson Matchbox, which was a balanced type antenna tuner. And by the way, the Johnson 250-watt Matchbox is good for 1,000 watts. Because that was 250 watts AM, which is four times the power, it's peak power. So it can handle 1,000 watts of sideband power. MFJ makes a couple of tuners. MFJ is one of the few I know that's out there right now. Night Viking, I think they're still around. But if you can find the Johnson box, use the balanced tuner. You won't have 160 meters, but it'll work on all the other bands beautifully. And all the power you want to run in that little box.
That Johnson Matchbox, Hal, sounds like a real beauty. Does it still exist as a brand new product? I'm a little worried that it doesn't exist anymore. As such, if I wanted a Johnson Matchbox, the 250-watt version, I think I've got to find it somewhere on the surplus market because I don't think it's being manufactured anymore. I hope I'm wrong. K6DPZ, K2RIW, in the TechNet.
K2RW and Technet K6DBC. No, they're not being manufactured anymore. There's a lot of them floating around at hamfests, and you can even find a lot of them on eBay. And MFJ makes boxes that have a balun, so basically it would have a balanced output, and you could feed the simple antenna, you know, with 450 ohm ladder line to about 130 feet to cut the fed the center. Now, Hal, I'm putting myself in the shoes of a new guy who's getting on ham radio. He's listened to Rich and Hal and Dick, and he's fell in love with either the end-fed ZEP or the center-fed 80-meter dipole, 450-ohm open-wire line, and he decided that, gee, one of the very nice ways of doing that is the Johnson Matchbox, the 250-watt version. Give me a very rough guess. On the surplus market, that Johnson Matchbox, what does it sell for? Is it $50, $500? What's an approximate price that's about the right value for that Johnson Matchbox, Al? K6TPZ, K2RIW. Should be able to find them around between $100 and $200, depending if they have the directional coupler or watt meter in it, or just the basic box. Fantastic answer. Like it. We can take that to the bank, Hal. Okay. Now somebody knows what he's looking for when he goes to a flea market. One more call for a guy who chimed in that didn't have a question for us. Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot India Zulu. John, go right ahead, K2RIW and the Tech Man. Looks like John got called away. We're going to start a little bit earlier tonight with the mailbag, John, KC2WGB, and those geniuses that mail you these fantastic letters describing all kinds of ways of modifying science for their particular purposes, radio-wise. Give us a few of those emails that you've received this week, John. K6DPZ, here we go. KC2WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
It's Julio, Dick.
KC2WGB, Rich recognized. Before we go to Rich, I have a question for NY2H, if he's out there. Lou, are you out?
John, did you just call me? I'm watching 60 Minutes. I have you on in the background.
Yeah, he did. Go ahead, Lou. John, go ahead.
Yeah, Lou, just to let you know, I've been trying to access the chat room for a while, and it's not active. No big deal, but just want to let you know. KC2WGB. Dick, back to you.
You got it, Lou, for any comments on that?
Yeah, I'll take a look. NY2H.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lou. Rich, you want to make a further comment? N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, and N2EO. Yeah, at the beginning of the net, he said schools don't give a very good education on electronics. I don't really have a basis for comparison. You know, one will wonder if wait for me. I went to RCA Institute in the 70s. RCA Institute was run by the Radio Corporation of America. The schools were located across the street from the main post office on 34th Street in Manhattan, but right down the street from, I guess that was Penn Station. And I feel I got a reasonably good education there. Unfortunately, the school no longer exists. It became TCI, the Technical Careers Institute, because RCA didn't want to run it anymore. It was bought out by the instructors, which was okay. But then later on, integrated. I don't know what it is now. Go ahead, Dick.
And you brought up a good point there, Rich. When it comes to the RCA Institute, stand by a minute. When it comes to the RCA Institute, the so-called V7 or T3 course, that was a kind of a trade school run by real radio engineers. And as such, that gave you a rather good amount of instruction at that particular school.
your typical electrical engineering college these days doesn't do anywhere near as well a job, in my opinion. They delve very deeply into so-called Maxwell's equations, which you talk to a real antenna engineer who's building antennas day to day, tuning them up on a vector network analyzer and on an anechoic chamber. He essentially never uses Maxwell's equations. It doesn't give him useful engineering information in the form that he can use. They like to believe that somebody studies those equations, gets a sudden aha in operation, and all of a sudden goes out and builds an antenna. Absolutely not. I'm going to drop. So the way they teach it in school, because the guys coming out of your bachelor and master's school in electrical engineering, and some of these are very good schools, I interviewed those people because we wanted to hire an electrical engineer for the company I was working for at the time, Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and later on other companies that I've worked for. I interviewed guys fresh out of school, and I rapidly came to the conclusion they essentially do not know what an antenna is. In the case of computer science and engineering science, those guys come out of there with a course that is updated every single semester, is kept current, and as such, in a very short period of time, they can earn an occupation in that field. Whereas in the RF field, the wireless field, you want a guy that designs antennas, you hire a guy that's got the summa cum laude record with a real good school, bachelor or master's degree, and you want him to be an antenna engineer? No way, Jose. That subject is not covered by my standards. So a lot of room for improvement. And as I talk to the professors of electrical engineering at the modern schools in the New York City area, and I ask them how come, their answer I get is a sort of a peculiar answer. Oh, I see I didn't have my speech processor turned on. I get a sort of a peculiar answer, and the answer is, well, these people haven't been given enough mathematics to understand it. sounds to me like what has happened is that the curriculum was set in 1947 when they wrote the Radiation Laboratory series of 20 books right after World War II, and they haven't updated the curriculum since in that particular field. Whereas the, let me drop. Whereas the computer science field, they update that course every single semester to keep it current. Modern day wireless equipment, your Wi-Fi phone, your tablets, your remote control for various appliances around the house and whatever. All modern day equipment is the marriage of computers and wireless hardware. The wireless hardware, the instruction for that is being kept current. You need both. The computer will not talk wirelessly. The wireless equipment won't do all the modern protocols of communication without the microprocessor inside. You need the marriage of both. We're doing a pretty good job of teaching how to build and how to program those microprocessors. By my standards, we're doing a very poor job of teaching how to build the antenna. You can have a gold-plated transmitter, a platinum-plated receiver, without an antenna connecting the two, you've got nothing. And we don't teach antenna engineering by my standards. That's a bunch of opinions. You're allowed to say you disagree. Hey, John, go to your first website. Here we go. Your first email, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KC2WGB, TechNet, mailbag. And good evening to everyone on the net, Paul, Dick. All right, I have a young amateur who happens to have in his possession three items that I know. He has three handsets. The G1 handset that has the button in the handle in the crossbar, and they're labeled sound-powered phones. He'd like to know what they're about, how they work, and what they're good for. Maybe you can give him a quick rundown on that. Back to you, Dick.
On a quickie or a long explanation? I was about to pass it over to you, Hal. When it comes to sound-powered phones, I worked for the Telephonics Corporation for a few years where they built...
Repeater, time out.
You want me to take it, Dick? Try to turn it over to you. As I said, I worked for the Telephonics Corporation where they built sound-powered phones. But I'm not completely familiar with what it really is, so bring us up to speed on that one, Hal. Wait for the beep.
Sound-powered phones are no more than a dynamic
microphone, basically. And a dynamic microphone basically is where you have a diaphragm that moves into a magnetic field, develops a voltage. This audible voltage is then sent to the other telephone over a pair of wires and makes the other dynamic cartridge vibrate like a regular headphone. So they work both in way, both ways. You don't need any battery bias on them. They just work by sound. You talk into the one phone on one side, and the other individual on the other phone hears it on the other. Generally, they have two sound-powered dynamic cartridges in each phone. So that's a quickie answer. Go ahead. Now, those sound-powered phones, were they used on aircraft where you've got a whole lot of background noise with a big enough set of earmuffs to sound to drown out all the noise of the airplane? Could a guy with sound-powered phones talk from the tail gunner to the pilot, so to speak? Were they used in foxholes? Give us a couple of words, Hal, from your point of view, where were sound-powered phones used? You've got it, Hal. They were used in foxholes during the war. That was one of the applications, sound-powered phones, and more current applications, they used to use them a lot in the TV field, where somebody would be setting up a TV antenna on the roof, and a person down below would connect the sound-powered phone on the 300-ohm line, somebody else at the other end would put the sound-powered phone on the other end of the 300-ohm line to fed the TV aerial, and they would talk back and forth to get best picture quality.
A two eyes that...
I did recognize. Go to you in a second. Hal, with reasonable gauge of wiring, 300 ohm wiring is what I think you said, what kind of range could you get out of a sound-powered phone? 50 feet? 150 feet? 500 feet? What do you believe is the range limitation on those, Hal? Hal first, K2LIW.
You could go at least maybe 300-400 feet. Thing is, the further away, you just have to yell a lot louder, but they'll work. There's no question on that.
Very good information, Hal. Mr. IZ, give us your full call letters and your information on this subject. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Tech John, Kilo 2 India Zulu. Shipboard. All the phones for battle communications were sound-powered phones. You had the circuits all over the ship, and the nice thing was if the headset got knocked out, you could use the mouthpiece to hear. But I know in modern Navy now they use other stuff, but everything we had back then, there was sound-powered phones. You look at the old war movies with the guy standing there with the big battle helmet on and that thing hanging off his chest, a sound-powered phone. We'd go alongside the carrier to refuel, toss across the wire, sound-powered phone. We'd talk ship to ship. Just across the sound, over.
Gee, that's very useful information, I said, John. Fantastic. If I had a 950-foot-long tanker, and I've got a guy in the bow of the ship, and I got a guy in the stern of the ship, I want to talk to each other. Do you believe sound-powered phones might be able to carry over that much of a range, John? K2IZ, K2LIW?
I forget how long the tankers were, but you always caught the guys in the bow. Let's see, we were 365 feet long. Yeah, the guys at the forward station, they could talk to the guys in aft steering, no trouble. And radio central, we had anyone on the ship could reach us. We were up at the O2 level. All you had to do was hit the dial, select who you wanted, turn the crank, sound like a duck in... sound like a homesick duck warbling, and you pick it up and answer. But I know they work the same way on the carriers, so yeah. That was communications all over the place, Dick.
The old dynamo generators when they were doing that, the hand cranks. They had the old hand crank generators when they were doing that.
Yeah, I was going to ask that from the next step.
John, when it comes to that hand crank, how did you alert the guy that he should pick up that particular set of headphones, the sound-powered phones? You turned the crank and it made a wobbling sound? Is that what you were saying, John? K2IZ.
to RAW.
Roger, RAW.
I say, yeah, you had the phones with the selector, and you just turned it to whichever was marked on there. But when we buttoned up for general quarters, everybody had a sound-powered phone, and you had the circuits all over the ship that didn't even bother with the cranks. You just were on there, plugged in your headset into the jack, and in my case, it wasn't my job, but the guy come on, he called the bridge, bridge radio central, emergency radio manned and ready. And that was just an open circuit, just like this thing here. But, that was for battle conditions. And again, everybody was tied in. You had your emergency teams, you had your damage control teams.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, Don, good information, John. Thank you. Hey, we've learned a lot more about sound-powered phones tonight, John. That's a new one on me. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
One comment about sound-powered phones also.
You got it, Hal.
What it was, when you used the crank dynamo, the sound-powered phone was not put online. The other side would have a bell. As soon as you plugged the sound-powered phone online, it disconnected the bell and made the line hop for two sound-powered phones.
Fantastic. Now we see a little bit more about the... And that bell got rung by the guy turning the crank. Is that approximately true, Al?
Right to one side, turned the crank, generated about 90 or 100 volts AC, and the other side was a bell. But once they got done turning the crank, then it swing over and just put the sound power phones online.
Was there a safety there? If the guy had the sound power phone in the active mode, not in the bell ringing mode, and somebody turned the crank, would that create hearing damage? Would that create damage to the equipment? Was there a failure mechanism there, Hank? Al, K6DPZ, K2RIW?
I think the phone was on some sort of a hook switch. So once he engaged it, the dynamo was disengaged. Or was put into a switched load, so there was no chance of the dynamo's signal going into the phone and blowing up the cartridge.
Well done. Sounds like a well-designed system. Sounds to me like it had three wires instead of two wires to do all that. And looks like somebody really worried about those fine details. Sounds to me like they were used for a lot of years. Sounds like they're being used today. How about that? And you know an awful lot about surplus equipment, Hal. If I went to go out and buy a set of sound-powered phones today, roughly how many dollars? What brand name should I look for? K6DPZ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K6DPZ. Okay, first off, the dynamo was off one side of the line to ground, which was not a balanced line. Balanced line was a sound-powered phone, so there was no problem about getting high level right across the phone cartridge. The ground was used as the third return for ringing. Today, I'm not sure who really has them. You would have to check with a few of the surplus places and see if you can locate some. I know they're around. I think Philco or Sylvania made some a long time ago. And you mentioned the company you worked for, but I would not venture to say any more where they could be gotten. You just have to do some research on the Internet.
Info, pal.
Person who wants info, go right ahead with your question. First identify yourself.
Yeah, Nick, this is WA2EXO, your EIL person. Look, I was a communications instructor for the United States Army way back when, and sound power phones were something that I knew about. They cranked them up. They had a switchboard. It could be audible. It could light up. There was a little eyelid, and that eyelid would open up when a call came in. So you could defeat the sound and the lights for field operations, so the enemy wouldn't see that things were going on. So I used those phones when I was in the Army. This is WA2XO. Back to you.
WA2AXO, K2RIW in the segment. Hey, Paul, thanks an awful lot. Good information, first-hand experience with Nissan-powered phones. You were there on the front line using them. Paul, by the way, is the man who publishes the weekly report for the AIL, Airborne Instruments Laboratory retirees, and I think he's been doing it for roughly 20 years. Every single week for roughly 20 years. Is that approximately correct, Paul? W2AXO, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, I started out with packet on 2 meters for the hams in the club off AIL. So, yeah, it's been a long, long time. And you're right, it's called the AIL Retiree Net Newsletter. Reason it's net because I do have a net on the low bands and on 2 meters. So it's been going on for quite a while. Back to you.
And one last piece of nostalgia. You were in the past on multiple occasions the president of the Amateur Radio Club of Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I should remember, my mind is failing. What were the call letters of the AIL Amateur Radio Club? B2AXO, wait for the beeps, K2LAW.
The call was WA2BPO, Baker Peter Oscar, and we had quite a wonderful radio station at the facility, the AIL, and the club had, maybe 25 or 30 members in the beginning. Go ahead.
And some darn good people. Hank Keane, all of a sudden I can't think of Hank Keane's call letters. He's the man who essentially invented strip line techniques. We also had, I'm trying to think of some of the other, Warren Offutt, another rather famous person, the president of the club, the president of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, Mr. John Dyer, was a ham radio operator. He was the radio operator for Admiral Byrd during some of the South Pole expeditions. So almost every single product the Airborne Instrument Laboratory manufactured for its 50-some-odd years of history had something to do with radar. Radar transmitters, radar rotary janks, W2CTK, was Hank Keane's call letters. Rotary joints, transmitters, receivers, antennas, modulators, power supplies, airborne surveillance, reconnaissance, airborne jamming equipment. My goodness, almost every single product for every one of those 50 years. So when Paul and I worked for that particular company, let me drop. We had one hell of an apprenticeship when it comes to radio equipment. We wanted to know how transmission lines, waveguides, antennas, rotary joints, transmitters, receivers, radars, modulators, you wanted to know how any of that stuff worked. You walked into that department and you started talking to somebody. It was a college. Man, was that one hell of a place. And those were the good old days. Everybody talks about the nostalgia in the good old days, but wasn't that one hell of a company to work for, Paul? W2AXO, K2RIW.
ZUM.
ZUM, Echo.
Somebody wants to cut ZUM. I don't know what that is. But anyway, yes, one heck of a company. You could walk into a department, antenna department, you had a question, you go in there, you get all kinds of, there's people that wrote the book on antennas at AIL. So, yeah. And especially, Dick, if I walked in your cubicle, we'd be an hour chewing the fat for hours. So, back to you. It's WA2AXO.
But we shouldn't have missed that there, Hank. Mr. ZUM, give me the full set of calls and your question or comment. ZUM, K2RIW and the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. This is KC2ZUM. This is Alan. Just came into the net, and I just wanted to say the phones that you were talking about, you can get them from a surplus place called Fair Radio Sales, Lima, Ohio. They still print a catalog, and they sell a lot of military surplus communications gear. Back to you. It's KC2ZUM, Echo Link, Fishkill, New York.
Very good information, Alan. Fair Radio Sales, Lima, Ohio, sells sound-powered phones. Roughly roughly what price range are we talking about here, Alan? KC2ZUM? K2LIW?
I couldn't say, Dick. I haven't really looked at the price recently. I just know that they carry them. I've purchased things from them before, and...
Yeah, what you're hearing is that occasionally the echo link goes into a failure mode where it sounds like overmodulation, and that's what I'm pretty sure Alan did run into, but he wasn't sure of the price, but Fair Radio's got him. Fair Radio is a nice catalog to get a hold of. I'd recommend you Google that one, get a hold of that catalog, because they've got an awful lot of very nice products at reasonable prices. Okay, John, we're a little bit ahead of schedule tonight. I think you should go to at least one more, if not two more, of the mailbag. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet. I'm pretty sure you'll come over all this jazz.
I'll copy the message.
Copy is quite good, so please proceed.
Okay, very good. Let me let her drop. That ain't going to work. All right, he had one additional question. He'd like to know if anybody, the impedance, maybe somebody would know. I believe they were 600 ohm, but I'm not sure. Maybe Hal is still there. He wants to try to interface this with his mobile radio and use it. It'll be more convenient than using a speaker. So maybe you or Hal have some input on that.
Yeah, Hal, do you think those sound-powered phones were in the vicinity of 600 ohm impedance? K16PZ, if you're still there. K2LIW.
K16PZ. I think there's 600 or higher, because remember, being a sound-powered phone, they wanted to develop more voltage for distance they have to carry. And if it was very low impedance, they really wouldn't carry that much. It has to be more voltage fed than current fed.
Solid copy, Hal. That's a good piece of information, and thank you. Now, let me do a quick check here. See if I'm able to get through.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
For any of you guys that are hearing things that you shouldn't be there, please listen on the reverse. In other words, listen to the input of the repeater. Whatever you hear, tell us where you were located, how strong it was, and when you heard it, and report it to RFI@limox.org. RFI stands for Radio Frequency Interference. So report it to radiofrequencyinterference@limox.org. I can tell by what I'm hearing on the input, this particular guy is mobile tonight. Sometimes he's fixed. Tonight he's mobile and creating as much mischief as he possibly can. Let's see if we can get into the very next one, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Check, I'm out of here. K6DPZ clear.
Thank you, Hal. Bye-bye for now. John, you've got it.
K2WGB. And thank you, Hal. Yes. All right, Dick. This gentleman needs the long answer. He recently took a cell phone apart, and he noticed the antenna structure. Now, I don't know if this is metamaterial or what, but it seems to be a type of dielectric antenna. He'd like to know, you know, it's a slow wave structure. I'd like you to explain how that works, what makes it a slow wave, and the fact that it's only 3/4 to an inch long, that's amazing. And this is a fairly new cell phone, so maybe you could give me some information on a slow wave antenna that they would use in a cell phone.
Okay, I'll go as far as I can until we time out the machine, and then when it comes back, I'll continue the conversation. Lucky for me, I listen to the output, so I know which words come through. The word slow wave has got multiple meanings. There's a whole class of antennas that have a slow wave structure to them. Believe it or not, a long Yagi antenna, the array of directors on a... The array of directors on a Yagi antenna, on a long Yagi antenna, is a slow wave structure. With inside of the traveling wave too, the helix is a definite slow wave structure. And there's other kinds of coupled cavity type of traveling wave tube, which is a slow wave structure. In the case of most of the slow wave structures that are really classically slow wave structures, they are multiple wavelengths long of physical size. So